KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Yesterday, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke signaled another rate cut is in the offing for later this month, the latest indication that recession worries are reaching a critical mass. Some economists think the recession is already here, others are less sure, but there seems little doubt that a slowing economy is the new reality. What to do about that new reality is, of course, another matter. We'll talk about the prospects for a recession and what, if anything, should be done to counter those worries. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Last week's news about sluggish job growth and increased unemployment seemed to represent a kind of tipping point in how people see the current state of the economy. This is unambiguously negative, said Mark Zandi, chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com. The country is on the edge of recession. So there's plenty of talk these days about the prospects of a recession, but what exactly does that mean? The traditional definition of a recession is two or more quarters when economic activity declines. That traditional definition hasn't been met yet, but everyone points to the same areas of concerns: housing woes, the credit crunch, oil prices, rising unemployment, and worries about declining consumer spending. Whether a recession becomes official or not, the question is, how much economic pain are we going to experience in the months ahead, and what, if anything, should be administered as the antidote? The Fed looks like it will cut rates again, so will that help? The president says Congress should make his tax cuts permanent. Is that the right approach? Democrats counter that any assistance should be short-term and targeted at those who need help most. And some economists say that any cure may create more problems than it will solve. So this morning on Forum, we want to take up what the prospect of a recession means and what, if anything, we should consider doing to improve the current state of the economy. Joining us this morning to take up that topic, Mike Mandel. He's chief economist for Business Week magazine. He joins us this morning from New York City. Mr. Mandel, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Joining us as well, Brad DeLong, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor DeLong, good morning.
Good morning.
And here, too, is William Beach, director of the Center for Data Analysis at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Mr. Beach, good morning.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks all very much. So let's begin, perhaps, with the news of the last 24 hours, which is Fed Chairman Bernanke signaling that rates are going to be cut at the Fed once again. Mike Mandel at Business Week, is that likely to stem much of the worry about recession?
I don't think so. I think it may actually add to the worries about recession, because it's confirming that the Fed chairman actually agrees with people that things really are heading down, and it represents a change in his position that perhaps big rate cuts weren't needed. I mean, you identified that as the news, incidentally. I wouldn't have called that the major news. I would have called the major news a couple of sort of real economy things, both sort of the real weakness in retail sales that is being reported by chains, and also the increase in today's trade deficit. So I would sort of say that the Bernanke news, he's kind of following now, and that the real news is the weakness in the economy.
And Brad DeLong, will a cut in rates do much to spur spending? What do we know about whether or not it will improve what Mike Mandel was just referring to?
No, it won't do much to improve spending. That is, cuts in interest rates have relatively little effect on business investment. They can have substantial effects on housing investment by reducing mortgage rates and reducing the costs for house builders to actually get the money they need to build houses, but housing's in a free fall right now and won't respond to interest rates. The only big channel is that cutting interest rates is going to lead to a weaker dollar, which is going to boost our exports, and that will have a relatively minor effect on the state of the economy.
So boosting exports, though, is one of the things that could come about?
Yes, is one of the things that's definitely going to come about if the Federal Reserve keeps lowering interest rates.
And William Beach, what's your take on the news of the last week, going back to the job figures from last week through the Bernanke announcement and the retail sales figures that Mike Mandel was also quoting?
Well, you'd have to be in a hole, or you'd have to be in a dark place somewhere to not sense that the economy is really significantly slowing. Our own forecasts actually have the GDP, our gross domestic product growth, for the fourth quarter of 2007 at nearly zero. And the probability of recession in the models that we run has risen from 35 to 40%, which is a big increase on a month-over-month basis. Nearly the only thing that's the silver lining here is the export growth. As long as we have, you know, fairly significant growth in foreign economies, some of which are oil-driven, others of which are just strong economies, we'll continue to see the United States growing and avoiding a recession in the first half of 2008. But it is a very close call indeed.
Can I just jump in for a second to sort of add to one thing about the effects of interest rate cuts? One thing that interest rate cuts can do is liquefy the financial system and kind of avoid any big splats on the financial side.
Okay, thanks for that. Mike Mandel, you've also written that your big concern is that in the past, American consumers sort of spend no matter what. Is your biggest worry right now that that's not really going to happen based on what you've seen from those December retail sales?
Well, it's more than that. It's more that that financial institutions, credit card companies, banks have been willing to facilitate all that spending by through their lending. Okay, lending both on the mortgages and also lending on the credit cards. And I think what we're going to see is when it's a real retrenchment on the financial institution side, that is a contraction of credit, not just mortgages, but credit cards. And we start to see this. American Express made an announcement yesterday. I think we're going to start seeing, finally, American financial companies are going to realize that you can actually lose a lot of money lending to consumers. And once they pull back that credit, what's going to happen is that American consumers are not going to have the lending to support. They may want to spend, but they're actually going to be forced to pull back. And I think we're going to see a much sharper drop on the consumer side than most people are expecting.
And how, Brad DeLong, does that ripple out then through the rest of the economy? I mean, walk us through sort of how the ripple effect of that is. If people start spending less, then how does that affect jobs? How does that affect the rest of the economy?
Well, first, I've been expecting American consumers to cut back on their spending for 5 years now, and I've been wrong each time. And so the question is, are we facing a permanent situation in which household savings rates will be very, very low, and are Mike's worries overblown? Or is it that we've just jumped off the top of a 100-story building and have now fallen 80 stories and are saying, so far, so good,
right,
as to what happens with consumer spending? Well, if consumers stop spending or even cut back spending, then a whole bunch of people who are employed in the businesses that they buy from are going to find that they're losing their jobs. Macy's reported this year that, its same-store sales were 7% lower than last year. That means Macy's now has an awful lot of inventory that it didn't expect it had that it will have to move over the next 3 months, which means it will be buying less and also probably employing fewer salespeople. Those salespeople will lose their incomes and they won't be spending. And the businesses that ship the clothes to Macy's, well, they won't ship as many clothes and so they won't employ as many people. And so they'll lose their jobs and they won't be spending. And the fear is that this will snowball through the multiplier effect, that what starts out as a relatively small twitch as consumers become more cautious and pessimistic and cut back on their spending leads to a substantial decline in employment and production as the people who were relying on the demand of others to employ them suddenly find that that demand isn't there.
Brad DeLong, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, joining us this morning along with William Beach, the director of the Center for Data Analysis at the Heritage Foundation, and Mike Mandel, chief economist for Business Week. William Beach, what about the role of housing in all of this? Can you connect a direct line from the housing worries that have been experienced in the past year or so and the consumer spending? Are those two things directly connected?
Well, we think they are directly connected, and that connection, the relationship continues to be a dominant one for the future of the economy. We may have had a significant asset bubble caused by a number of things in the housing industry, and I think all the evidence does point to that. And it also, we had something happening in the credit world which was tied to mortgages and the way in which companies that issue and hold mortgages hedge against the non-performance of mortgages and sell the mortgages from one company to the next. It's a complicated world that was out there in the 1990s and the early part of the of this decade, and it, in fact, developed a very complex credit structure that was tied in large part, to the mortgages. When houses began to go back onto the market because the owners of those houses couldn't maintain their mortgages, perhaps the mortgages shouldn't have been issued in the first case to these people that didn't have the incomes to maintain them, then that whole credit structure was challenged and began to have serious problems. We saw that in August and September. Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve and of course, the White House came in to shore up those markets to encourage them with words and deeds. And we thought in November that we were beginning to work our way out of that, only to find in December that we were back into a crunch in the credit side, which was easily as large as August. It all goes back into the construction industry. We're looking at a continued contraction, not only in what's called residential construction throughout 2008, but also in the value of the existing homes. I'm looking at perhaps ending the year with a further 10% reduction in the average value of houses across the entire country. Of course, that varies enormously from San Francisco to El Paso, Texas.
Well, let's jump in on that point, if I might. And why don't you pick up the story at that point, Brad DeLong, with what the peculiarities of that are here in California and whether or not worries about housing have a particular effect or not. I mean, in some ways, parts of California, parts of the Bay Area have been immune to some of those housing trends. So what are we vulnerable about as this all connects up here in this state?
Well, one vulnerability is the one that Mike started out by talking about, is that a huge number of people have taken a look at what's happened to the values of their houses over the past 5 years and have said, wow, I'm rich, and have used their houses as gigantic automatic teller machines.
Right.
You need an extra $10,000, run up another $10,000 on the home equity loan. And if those home equity loans are now not gettable or not as easily gettable or come with much higher interest rates attached, then you have a whole bunch of consumers stopping their spending with the multiplier effects on the rest of the economy, unless there's some other sector to take up the slack and replace that demand, which would be exports in this case if we're lucky. So that's one thing, simply the fact that with the cooling off of the housing market, people are no longer saying, gee, we're really very rich, let's use our housing machine as a gigantic automatic teller. Second worry is that say, because of enthusiasm, because of low interest rates, because of TV shows that say you can make an absolute fortune by buying a house, spending $30,000 remodeling it and flipping it for a whole bunch of reasons, we've built a huge number of extra houses over the past 7 years, say 3 million or so nationwide, of which I think about a quarter are in California, most of those in Riverside and San Bernardino counties. And those are 3 million houses, and there are 3 million households living in them right now. And those 3 million households are those that are kind of at the edge as far as home ownership has been concerned, that their incomes aren't high enough or aren't secure enough or aren't steady enough, that in a normal world in which you have to pass some kind of bank examiner's frown to get a mortgage, that they can't get prime mortgages, so they have the subprime mortgages. And so what's going to happen now over the next 3 or 4 years is that a whole bunch of those people are going to say, look, you sold us this house thinking that we could make these mortgage payments. We really can't. Now, what are you going to do about it? One possible thing that would happen would be a whole bunch of renegotiations. We shouldn't have taken out this loan, true, but you shouldn't have lent us the loan on those terms, also true. You are the financial experts. You're supposed to know who can support this kind of house, this kind of mortgage payment. We need to share the losses. And the good thing that happens is over the next 3 years that the losses are shared, between homeowners on the one hand and mortgage lenders on the other, and the people who gave the money to the mortgage lenders and the people who gave the money to the people who gave the money to mortgage lenders, and
right.
so on down until you get to Merrill Lynch, which is this morning reporting a $15 billion little problem in their kind of asset side. And that's the good way to deal with it. The bad way is to take those 3 million households and to foreclose on them and evict them.
Yeah.
And then you have 3 million houses standing empty and 3 million households that have lost whatever equity they have and are now living in their cars and with their in-laws in the city.
And which ripples out in turn in all kinds of ways through the rest of the economy.
3 million houses that are then standing empty because the 3 million households you've just evicted, those are the 3 million that are actually the richest.
Right.
So, and the best of the non-prime mortgage gaining households.
So now that we can see through all of your points, the ways in which all of these things connect up, from housing to worries about consumer spending, which in turn affect the job markets. So we have this situation, which everyone seems to agree about. I mean, there's no one really arguing, oh, everything looks terrific. So that takes us back, Mike Mandel, then, to what to do about it and whether or not there is a stimulus package that makes sense or whether or not we'd be better off not doing anything at all. Walk us through some of what those options might be and the pros and cons.
Yeah. Let me just point out one thing, which is that there is one part of the economy which is quite strong, which is healthcare and education. And if you look at the last job report, you could see quite a few jobs being generated there. And these sectors have gotten bigger over time. And there is a question about whether or not, and these sectors are government funded for the most part, so that we're already we're kind of running a health and education Keynesian policy right now. We're pumping in stimulus through Medicare and through our education spending, which might be enough to sort of actually keep us out of a formal recession. So remember that it isn't a completely bleak picture, and the government is doing something, even though it's not kind of what we conventionally think of as economic policy. All right, so that's actually a plus for the economy. Then the next question is you have the monetary policy, you have the fiscal policy. On the monetary side, Fed's going to cut rates. It could help the financial industry, for example, Merrill Lynch, not have to go under, and that's good. On the fiscal policy side, tax cuts, spending increases right now, there's nothing that can be done to really for the next 6 months, 9 months, whatever. And part of it is it's just not going to happen fast enough. And the second part is, it's a political season. It's a presidential
right.
campaign. And nothing will happen quickly. There is nothing that will happen quickly enough to sort of help the economy right now. And it's not clear that there is anything that should be done right away on the fiscal side, because frankly, I'm with Brad on this. Okay, we've had a consumer. I view what's happening right now as the outcome of a long consumer spending bubble. It isn't simply a housing bubble. It's a long consumer spending bubble where people have really overspent kind of their long-term income, and it's going to have to come down slower fast.
And William Beach, do you concur with that there's really nothing that could be done quick enough to make a real difference?
Well, when I stand just outside the Beltway, I can totally concur with that. That's the rational way of looking at things. And yes, we're working through our problems, and the lenders and the borrowers are finding ways of getting those loans repaid, and companies are being reorganized. But when I step then inside the Beltway, I'm overwhelmed with this sense that Congress wants to act and act now. I think there's going to be a stimulus package, and I think it's going to pass, be signed, because it is such a politically attractive piece of legislation to get out during an election year. So that's unfortunate in some respects.
And a stimulus package, sorry to interject, but just specify, if you would, what that might contain, what that might entail.
Oh, my. It could contain anything. Honestly, for those of us who are old enough, we remember the Surface Transportation Act of 1983. It was passed at a time when everyone in the Congress believed we were on the verge of a massive 1930s-length recession, maybe a depression. And so there was this massive public works program that was passed. Of course, the very next year, the expansion was well underway, which is another thing that Congress does. They hardly ever pass things at time. We won't get that this year, but we could get some spending like an increase in the unemployment benefits, food stamp increases, refundable tax credits. From my standpoint, I think that anytime you have an economic slowdown, it's a great time to have a discussion about good, solid, sound economic policy. And you should always, I think, because you don't have the data for a year to know what kind of condition you're in, look out into the future. So there's many things we can do now to improve our regulatory structure, our tax structure, which needs reform, to get spending under control that would really help the economy in the long run, and actually might have some help in the short run in that it signals to investment officers, to people who are making spending decisions, that we're not going to be doing bad things in the short run that'll have worse consequences in the long run. But let me tell you this.
Yeah.
There's going to be a stimulus package of some sort, seriously debated. Let's just hope that Congress sees the light and doesn't pass something that does harm to the economy.
William Beach at the Center for Data Analysis at the Heritage Foundation. Brad DeLong, on the temptation for Congress to do something, although it should probably also be added that Congress has not been terribly quick about making anything happen in the past year or so, but do you share Mr. Beach's assessment that the temptation will be so great for Congress in a political year to say, we're on this, we're doing something, that something will in fact come through?
And that every lobbyist in Washington, D.C. is now strategizing how to make the thing that does their gets the most money to their clients.
You understand Washington.
As possible. Yeah, you know, I mean, that is, if there's one lesson the past 50 years seems to teach us, it's that Congress is institutionally incapable of performing this kind of stabilization balance wheel function for the economy.
So do you concur that with both Mike Mandel and William Beach that the best thing to do right now is not anything at all?
Well, no, not anything at all. It's simply that the Congress is the wrong institution.
Yeah.
Right? It will do things that will take too long to have their effects, and that afterwards we're likely to turn around and say, why did we do this? We gave away a lot of money to people who actually weren't spending it fast enough for it to do much good at the economy. And now we have a bunch more national debt that we have to pay interest on. And we've enriched a bunch of lobbyists and convinced a bunch of businesses and others that they ought to be spending even more money on lobbyists to tweak government spending even further in their direction. At the moment, at least, this is a kind of Federal Reserve monetary and bank regulatory policy issue, and they're institutions that are much better positioned and capable of handling it.
Hmm. Mike Mandel, sorry to interject, but we have to go to a break. Mike, did you want to get in something real quick?
No, except I agree with Brett on this, that the Fed has the possibility to sort of keep the financial system from breaking, and that's really the most important thing at this point.
All right, we'll hold it there and get back to all of you on what we ought to be considering doing right now, if not for Congress to do immediately, then what sorts of things should we consider long-term when we come back? We welcome your questions and thoughts about this, too, what the current state of the economy is and what we ought to think about doing to try to improve things. You can join us now at 866-733-6777. 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. Back with more from William Beach, Brad DeLong, and Mike Mandel about the current state of the economy, the prospects for a recession, and what might we do to improve things when we come back. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the prospects for recession and the prospects for doing something about it. Joining us to talk about that, Mike Mandel, Chief Economist for Business Week. William Beach, Director of the Center for Data Analysis at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. And Brad DeLong, Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley. We welcome your participation in our conversation, too. You can do that by joining us now. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Right before the break, William Beach, I think you were trying to get in. I thought it was Mike Mandel, but you wanted to add something in. So let me get to you first.
Well, I think you were mentioned that we should basically just let the economy go forward and so forth and not do anything. And I think what we need to do is to tell the policymakers that their job is keeping their eye on policy. And that means keeping their eye on the long term. Now, let's just put ourselves in the position of a business owner thinking about whether to expand his or her business and hire 5 more people. They're saying, are my taxes going to go up? Is my regulatory burden going to remain the same? So forth and so on. Because those are issues that people think about when they're about to expand their business. One of the things that Congress can do now, without doing particular harm to the economy, is to signal what tax policy is going to look like after 2010, when the Bush tax cuts expire, and to begin a process of regulatory reform review to make sure that those regulations that are in place are needed, are effective, and not just burdensome. When the economy is slow, sometimes just the action in the right direction by Congress of doing the right things to improve policy is enough of a signal to say to that business owner, yes, I should go forward with that expansion, and then 5 more people are hired. So it isn't that Congress can't do a stimulus package. It's how they act and what they do that is important. Short term, they don't have the data to act. I mean, we may be in a recession right now. It may have started in November. We won't know for a year. But they do know that they need to have policy that's good for the economy in the long run. And I think this Congress should do more in that.
Brad DeLong, a brief response, and then we'll get to our calls. You heard William Beach make the argument that essentially it's not that extending the Bush tax cuts would fix anything immediately, but what that would do would be to add a level of predictability so that business owners in particular would know what sort of situation they're in. What's your reaction to that point of view?
Well, for that specific thing, I think it would add not predictability, but unpredictability. That is one of the biggest long-term problems facing the American government is we've made a whole bunch of commitments about how much the government is going to pay for medical care costs over the next century, a commitment that was expanded extraordinarily by President Bush with his Medicare Part D without having any clear idea of how that's going to be funded. So that at the moment, every business owner thinking about the long term in America is thinking that ultimately somebody is going to have to pay for Medicaid and for Medicare parts A, B, C, and D, and we don't know who. Because at the moment, taxes are programmed in the long run to be well below what's going to be needed to fulfill those health care commitments.
Yeah.
And so you extend the Bush tax cuts, you greatly increase the long run fiscal gap, and you make taxes in the long run even more uncertain and more unpredictable.
Yeah.
Because, as Milton Friedman liked to say, you know, to spend is to tax. Whether you raise or lower tax rates doesn't tell you whether you've raised or lowered tax rates. It's spending that commits you to taxing.
And the spending through what you're saying, the new prescription drug benefit, is something that we're going to have to figure out how to fund.
It's already out there.
Yeah. Let's get to our...
I'd reverse it, right? I would say that over the long run, the federal government ought these days to be running a surplus as the baby boomers approach retiring, and that anything that moves us away from a surplus toward a bigger deficit is going to be extraordinarily counterproductive.
Or to put it another way, Professor DeLong, federal government should be fixing Medicare and Social Security so it can be afforded in the future by the revenue stream that's available. I don't think anybody says that we should reform these two by increasing revenues. They're fundamentally structurally broken. As Moody's said this morning in a story that was carried over in the United Kingdom, they're going to downgrade United States Treasury bonds if we don't get Medicare, Social Security, and the other entitlements under control.
Let me hold you there and get our callers engaged in our...
You can act on the spending side. You can act on the tax side.
Let me hold you both there, if I might, before we get into too much of a discussion on that particular point, so that we can let our callers get engaged in their concerns about the current state of the economy. Let's go to Ken first, who joins us in Mill Valley this morning. Ken, go ahead.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
My question for your panelists is, what are their comments about the new law in Oklahoma, which requires employers to check the immigration status of their workers to basically comply with federal law? Do you think that such laws will be more widely adopted by other states, and what effect do you think this is going to have on the economy?
Ken, thanks for the call. Mike Mandel, sure. You want to take that?
Sure, I'll do a quick one. I think that once the presidential campaign is done, that we're going to find that immigration is as much part of our economy as anything else is. And I think the long-term movement is towards more free flow of people rather than less. And, you know, a lot of people are very concerned about the illegal immigrants, but it's very hard to sort of live in a global economy where there's a free flow of goods and a free flow of services and a free flow of capital without letting people move too. And you know, and this is going to be a real touch point for the economy, but I think that the long-term trends are very hard to beat.
And Steve in San Francisco joins us next. Steve, go ahead.
Hi there. Great show. I tuned in to the entire Brookings proceedings, and it was very interesting to hear Martin Feldstein and Bob Rubin talk about the actual process. One thing that came out of that, and I'm a University of Chicago economist, is that they need to have the four T's, and that is timely, targeted, temporary, and triggered. And so that means that any package that would need to be passed would have to be in process already right now. Especially in an election year, the cogs of the machinery are pretty slow to turn. Additionally, would the guests talk about the trickle-down? I think they've been concentrating on the federal side. On the state side, that's going to come down the pike, too. And one person said that the states have a rainy day fund. Well, I said to my wife, Madge, it's not a rainy year fund. It's right. A rainy day fund.
Steve, thank you. Let's get some reactions. On the first point, Brad DeLong, if you would, he was referring, I think, to a session that was held at the Brookings Institution yesterday that featured a variety of speakers talking about what to do. And this whole idea that Steve brings up, that if we're going to do anything, it needs to be timed and targeted to help a specific group of people. And you've all commented about how hard it is for Congress to do that. Is it not possible to do something very specific that would help those in need most, tied to our particular circumstances?
I don't see how with this Congress and this administration you can. Yeah, that is, if there has been one lesson over the past 7 years, it's that everything the Bush administration touches turns to muck. And I agree that Bob Rubin and Marty Feldstein are 100% right in saying that any stimulus has to be timely, targeted, and whatever the other two T's were.
Triggered and something, yeah.
I think that if we had a government in which they were cabinet members and in which the Finance and Ways and Means Committees deferred to them, we would have a good chance of getting there. That's not the world we live in.
Hmm.
Both Marty Feldstein and Bob Rubin now are largely outsiders without access to the levers of power or significant control over what the Office of Management and Budget proposes or over what the Finance and Ways and Means Committees dispose. And so I think that this is not a road that we should be going down right now. It's not going to lead us to a happy place.
Brad DeLong, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. I want to come back to something that was referenced in the first part of the program and see if I can get my arms around this notion a bit, Mike Mandel, because you were saying that one of the concerns is that people aren't going to keep spending, and we saw that in the December retail figures. But you were also saying that we've been on sort of a spending spree for perhaps too long a time, a spending bubble, not just a housing bubble. So are both things true? Are Americans spending too much, but then we're also worried that they're not going to keep spending?
I'm not worried that they're not going to keep spending. I mean, I think that this is one case where they were spending a lot, and you have to understand they were borrowing a lot to spend. That's what's important here is really sort of two-sided. They were spending, and financial institutions were willing to lend them the money to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And they were willing to lend them the money to do so because they believed that lending to consumers was always a win-win proposition. They would always make money on it. And so what's happened in this housing bust, it's really broken the lending side of the bubble so that the lenders now no longer believe that they're always going to make money. And now they're going to correctly assess the risk
of lending to American consumers. There's going to be a pullback, and when you get the pullback, the credit's going to become, you're not going to get so many credit cards in the mail. And all of a sudden, there's going to be a pullback in consumer spending, and we'll see the savings rate start to rise, which I'm not all that concerned about. But in fact, when you come to the end of a bubble, and this is a consumer spending bubble, there really isn't anything that you can do to stop it from unraveling. What you can do is cushion it, though. And that's what the Fed has to do, is has to cushion the fall. So you asked a question at the beginning of the show, is there any way to kind of stop this? And the part about the consumer pullback, which is part of that, which is part of the housing pullback, it's all part of a bigger picture. No, I don't think there's any way to sort of stop it at this point, because really people were spending too much.
Hmm. Bela in Sunnyvale is up next. Go ahead. Go ahead. Bela, are you with us?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. I have two questions for the panel. One, I would like to understand how this current war with Iraq and Afghanistan we are fighting has contributed to this economic crisis. And the second question is, from a purely economic standpoint, what are the best options we have in front of us towards this war? Not necessarily from a political or ethical perspective, purely from an economic standpoint, what we got to do?
Okay, thanks for the call and the question. William Beach, take that up. Cost of the war and how that's impacting our current economic state.
I get all the easy questions. the cost of the war is substantial. It is squeezing out some government spending. It is being produced, as we know, in large part on borrowed dollars. Wars are sort of like that. If the war is proves out to be one of the most important things we would have done in this period of time, and we're much safer as a result of the a successful conclusion, whatever that means, then it's worth it. And the economic payout will be in the future. If, on the other hand, critics of the war are correct that the war in Iraq, as opposed to Afghanistan and elsewhere, that it was unnecessary and that it, in fact, doesn't produce the kinds of payouts for the long term, then we will have basically spent nearly $1 trillion that could have been spent in private production in ways that that are not productive. In any way, it has exacerbated the liquidity drill down that we've been having for the past year that I think was necessary. I agree with that totally. It has certainly made it somewhat more painful for the U.S. economy now. It looks like it's a manageable outlay from the standpoint of avoiding recession and keeping the economy moving, but its effects, they will have to be assessed in the future, and it's hard to see exactly what their economic effects are right now.
This gets a bit, Brad DeLong, to the question of sacrifice. It's often said that we don't sacrifice enough in this country. We're not aware enough of the price that it takes to accomplish certain things, whether it's the war in Iraq or something else. Do we not have a keen enough sense of what those costs truly are? Are they not being felt, I guess, deeply enough at home?
Well, it seems to me there are two totally different issues here that should be pulled apart. And the first is the question of, are Americans kind of saving too little and spending too much? And are we kind of feckless grasshoppers who are looking forward to a world that'll be much poorer and nastier because we've spent all our money on remodeling our kitchens and on driving sports cars up and down Highway 1 when we ought to have been keeping our nose to the grindstone and piling up other investments for the future? And I'd say the answer to that is to some degree yes, but you know, the United States is still one of the richest countries in the world and certainly the most technologically capable, that we're not saving as much as we should be for most definitions of should. But this is a venial sin rather than a mortal sin. And the second question is, do we understand the costs of various foreign policy adventures and misadventures on, you know, the people who we send to perform our missions overseas and also on the people who we are supposed to be there trying to help? I have a second cousin right now who is a first lieutenant ranger with the 82nd Airborne Division in Baghdad, doing his best in a country where he doesn't speak the language to try to be a military policeman in Baghdad, trying to keep the Shiites from, with the militias with their guns, from killing people named Omar just because the Omar Caliph was supposed to have kicked the prophet's daughter in the belly back 13 centuries ago, and trying to keep Sunni militias with their guns from killing people named Ali, just because the prophet's son-in-law Ali did not recognize the authority of over the rightly guided Khalifa Omar back 13 centuries ago. I'm proud of him. He's doing his very best. But to have this highly trained and very brave guy being a military policeman in Baghdad is, there has to have been a better way to get there, and a way to get there that didn't lead to, what was the latest estimate, 400,000 extra Iraqis dying, you know, half from violence and half from dysentery and public health disrepair and other things. Since 2003?
Let me pull us back, if I might. I understand the concerns and the critique over the war, but I want to keep our focus, if we can, on how all of these things, whether it's the war or something else, affects our current economic situation. So let me get to a couple of very specific questions that have come in via email on that. Carol Rice from Redwood City, what does the prospect of a looming recession mean for a recent college graduate entering the job market? How does it affect the value of the American worker? Mike Mandel?
Over the last 6 or 7 years, the real wages for new college graduates have gone down. And that hasn't been a good thing. And that actually is partly what's been fueling some of the political activism among young people these days, because, in fact, they are demonstrably in a worse financial position than they were in the past. And there were signs of a little bounce up, but I kind of tend to agree that what a recession or a near recession or a pseudo recession, whatever you want to call it, the economic weakness is going to undermine the wages of new college graduates. It's certainly not going to come back up to 2000 level, and it's not going to feel very good.
And a similar question, Sriram writes, I'm a working single. Do panelists have suggestions about any precautions I can take to ride a recession storm?
Can I jump in?
Yeah,
right,
please.
There?
Yeah.
I think if there's going to be a credit squeeze on individuals, which is why I think is the first thing to do is for people to sort of put themselves in a situation where they're not depending on credit. Okay. And the people who are going to get killed going through this are the ones that are assuming that they can refinance through credit cards, that they can keep going the way they're doing. And that's like the most important thing, piece of advice that I would give to anybody going through this stretch right now.
And I have a story, Dave, on that.
William Beach, go ahead.
Everyone knows the famous actress Katharine Hepburn. And she reports in her recently published autobiography, that her father decided in 1928 that things were getting a little tight and he ought to be debt-free. Katharine Hepburn's husband, young man, decided in 1928 that things were getting better and he should invest more in the stock market. I think that story should be a guidance for us, and that is when things are looking kind of dim like this, it's a really good thing to reduce as much of your debt as possible, because that gives you greater flexibility if your labor situation changes.
And are you also saying, William Beach, to be this is a time, are you making the analogy that this is a time when we should be careful about our stock market investments?
Well, let me just say that there are times when you want to be in bonds and there are times when you want to be in equities, and any prudent investor does move from one to the other if possible. It's important to also keep in mind that if we're moving through a difficult time when we're now getting liquidity out of the market and we're reducing bad debt and so forth and so on, that would imply to me strongly that within a few months, a year, the economy will be stronger than it would otherwise be if we didn't have this correction. So if you're graduating from college today, find a job, weather the storm, and expect the economy to be in better shape than it would otherwise be if we're able to keep Congress's hands off of what would otherwise be a wholesome correction to the marketplace.
Robert in San Francisco has a question. Go ahead, Robert.
Yes, I do. Thank you. And just as a note, I really appreciated your comments about your relative who was over in Iraq in terms of a military, in terms of economic presence and how it was a cog in affecting our economy.
That was Brad DeLong. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, and my question is this. I've had this question for about 40 years now. Now we're just hitting the window where it's actually people are being cornered into attempting to answer it, and they're not. What are you basing this economic recovery upon. What I saw 40 years ago was the rest of the world recovering. Sorry, you need a little history lesson here, recovering from World War II, recovering their industry, rebuilding their infrastructure, replacing their population with an educated scientific population that could compete in the economic world. Now the United States is there, and they're attempting to compete. And just as an example, I assume someone's going to say, oh, well, it's just going to happen. Well, is it in manufacturing? Is it a manufacturing base that you're going to recover this economy? Because I don't see it. All the manufacturing is being shipped abroad.
Yeah, let's
I'm sorry. Is it technological?
Yeah.
Is it extra?
I got you, Robert. I got you, Robert. Thanks. Thanks for the considerations and the concerns. And it's a fair question. Mike Mandel, take it up first on what
sure.
optimism, what is the basis
I'll
for any optimism?
I'll give you the short note. In the short run, the things that are growing are the things that we are spending money on, which is healthcare and education. And it's actually sort of stunning when you look at the numbers. These continue to generate jobs and they continue to grow. In the short run, these provide a floor for the economy. In the long run, what you want is you want to depend on innovation and technological change and the ability to develop new things that other people in the rest of the world want. Okay, so you have a difference between the sort of the short run and the long run. And there's a gap between the short run and the long run. I agree with the caller that depending on exports at this point, well, frankly, the manufacturing base has been sufficiently eroded where there's sort of some U.S. companies that sort of are doing well on a global basis, but even they may not have a lot of employees in the U.S. So you look to what we have now, which is healthcare and education, and then you sort of say, okay, what can we add on to that layer?
And Brad DeLong here in California, would you add the tech sector to that as a possibility for something that will grow?
Technological tech sector, yes, and technologically sophisticated exports especially. I have been surprised over the past 2 years by how rapidly America's exports have been growing, because 2 years ago I was kind of where Mike was and said that the manufacturing base has been sufficiently reduced.
Can I add something right here? Which is
hang on, please. Go ahead, Brad DeLong. Finish up.
Yeah, but the past 2 years of export growth have been quite attractive and quite interesting, and right now producers in Japan and Europe are absolutely howling at the competition that they're starting to face from American exporters as the dollar continues to fall. So I'd be somewhat more optimistic than Mike about exports over the next 3 or 5 years.
And I couldn't tell if that was Mike or William who wanted to jump in.
Just one note, which is our trade deficit in advanced technology has been growing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, over this same period. So it's there's a mixed picture here, but I actually think that the U.S. manufacturing. See, I was in Brad's position 2 years ago, and I've come around to the other side and become more negative. So,
All right, another caller wants to ask about the question of exports. So let's get to that caller, Hugh in Oakland. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. As you all know, one of the major potential markets is China. And the Chinese market is essentially taken away because the yuan is pegged to the dollar. So Chinese consumer products coming in stay cheap, and our products going to China stay expensive. Not only that, but it puts more emphasis on the euro and the European and Japanese economies, as well as other Southeastern Asian economies, because they face more cheap products coming in from China. So as the euro and their currencies increase, effectively putting pressure on their economies and negatively affecting the potential markets that the U.S. could export to.
Yeah, Hugh, thanks. Thanks for the call and the observation. Brad DeLong, just a quick response, because you brought up the question earlier that exports might save us. Hugh is saying because of the Chinese currency being pegged to ours, that won't necessarily happen.
It certainly won't happen as far as China is concerned for the next year or two. But China is only part of the world and still a small part of the world, right? A lot of people, not that big in the standpoint of the global economy, because it's very poor. And in the 3 to 5, 3 to 6 year time frame and thereafter, China's not going to be able to keep its current strategy of keeping its currency really, really cheap so it can export a huge amount. At some point, either the yuan will have to rise in value, or the things the People's Bank of China is doing to try to keep the yuan cheap are going to produce an explosion of inflation within China, which will do more or less the same job. That either way, the dollar wages of Chinese workers in Shanghai are going to be twice what they are now in 5 years. And a lot of their export advantage will be gone. And that might happen because the yuan increases in value. It might happen because of a lot of inflation in China. But it's going to happen.
Just have a few, just a minute or so left. So just a quick sum up comment from each of you, if I can get to each of you. William Beach first on what people ought to be thinking about, I guess, given the current shakiness of this, other than I think your recommendation is urge Congress not to do anything.
Well, I just want to have one final comment on that, and that is that we are at a difficult time in the economy, and I'll just add one thing to what Professor DeLong said. You know that China is hosting the Olympics this summer, and they're going to keep their economy going forward in a very robust way. I'm a little concerned about the shocks to their economy and to the world's economy after the Olympics when China begins to try to control its inflation.
Yeah, interesting.
That could be something to think about.
Mike Mandela, last quick comment.
I just think that 2008 is going to bring a sharper slump in consumer spending than people expect, and with a variety of positive and negative effects.
And Brad DeLong.
I think we're probably in a recession now. I get to put the odds at 60 to 70% that when the dust clears, we'll say the recession started in November when the Christmas season began and turned out to be worse than expectations.
We'll have to hold it there. Yeah, sorry to cut you off, but we are out of time. I want to thank Brad DeLong from the University of California, Berkeley, for joining us this morning, along with Mike Mandel at Business Week magazine and William Beach, director of the Center for Data Analysis at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks all for being part of our program. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Tina Lauerberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer, Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.